chapter 15, starting at verse 11, the parable of the lost son. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'"
Growing up, my Nana was one of my biggest champions. She led me to believe that I could do anything that I wanted to do or whatever it was I happened to be passionate about on any given day. I think this was perhaps because she didn't joke about her mother-in-law, who frequently said to her, "Hilda, if there's one thing you can do, it's make a sandwich." However, my Nana went the other way and thought I could do anything, apart from one thing, which was running. I am not built for running. I never, ever have been. I have such vivid memories of cross country in primary school. I must have just decided to phase out the memories of secondary school cross country, which was surely worse. En masse, primary 4 to 7 from Timmer Greens in Arbroath, would walk down to Kepty Pond, and we wouldn't just run round the pond, we would have to run up a massive steep incline and then back down. I was always last, or as close to last as possible. I absolutely hated it. If long distance wasn't my thing, neither was short distance. I have equally vivid memories of the dread of sports day. I loved the potted sports bit, you know, the throwing beanbags into hoops and the dribbling a ball in and out of cones. I could do those bits. But if my fear of cross country was great, my fear of running in front of an audience was even greater. I just absolutely hated it. I felt like All eyes were on me as I was making my way slowly towards the finishing line. Running is not for me. And just as running filled me with that sense of dread and embarrassment, so too is there a tension of embarrassment in the story of the prodigal son, both in the son's return and in his father's undignified act of running. In recent years, running has become more and more popular, with people enjoying running just for the enjoyment of it. I really don't understand that. Park runs sprout up. I saw yesterday somebody had completed their 100th park run in Arbroath. It's just not for me. But in Jesus's day, it wasn't customary for a grown man to be running. It was hugely undignified. And yet, as the son who had effectively wished his father dead crosses the horizon and into his dad's line of sight, the father whips off his sandals and hikes up his robes so that he can run to his son. He doesn't wait for him to come close. His love moves first. He cannot wait. He throws aside the social norms and expectations of the day and runs to the son that he had stood waiting for day by day. The son who had broken his heart and the son who he feared he may never see again. And the son had probably expected a reunion that at the very least would have required a bit of begging for mercy, an acknowledgement of his guilt, and probably a stern telling off from his dad. But before he can even utter a word, his father has run to him, wrapped him in a warm embrace, and weeps over the son that he thought was lost. In his returning, the son too would have been humiliated. He had left, full of confidence that he would find his way in the world. And all too soon, he's having to return with his tail between his legs, broken, penniless, and worse off than the servants who work for his father. He had sought to build a life based on the things of the world and the things that he thought would bring him happiness, a life filled with the finer things in life, good food, reckless living, and abandonment of responsibilities that seemed to tie him down at home. Yet, when the money goes, he realizes that building a life on those things will always lead to dissatisfaction and disappointment. While returning to his father's home might require hard work and repentance, he realizes that is far better than living for one day anywhere else. But more than his feelings of embarrassment, he'd have approached home full of trepidation, probably expecting to be shamed by his family and his community. In those times, it would have been a common custom for a returning family member to be greeted by a kazaza ceremony, a clay jar being smashed at their feet to signify their complete rejection by their family and wider community. Just as I dreaded finishing last with all eyes on me, the son must have dreaded stepping back into that village with all eyes on him. But the father's running meant that he would never have to face that walk of shame alone. Instead, the son's embarrassment and shame are hidden. The father takes on the embarrassment for himself and he runs to the son. The son is met with celebration instead of rejection and rejoicing instead of condemnation. The father saves his son from the public humiliation that was due him and takes it on for himself. The sinfulness of the son is completely overshadowed by the graciousness of the father. In this act, we see a picture of God's love. The Father steps in to absorb our shame, showing us that his divine grace can turn humiliation into restoration. The lost son is the third of the three lost parables, the first two being the lost coin and the lost sheep, each illustrating God's relentless pursuit of the sinner and their welcome back into the fold. But the sheep and the coin have no idea that they are lost. And yet the shepherd and the woman search and search until they have found them. And of course, that is what God does. He is always searching for those who are lost. But in the parable of the lost son, the focus is on the human role in turning back to God. God will pursue us, but we must also recognise the ways that we have turned away from him and turn back towards him. The father stood at the end of the road, day by day, waiting for his son to return. But it wasn't until he turned back that the father ran to meet him. The focus here is on the true restoration of relationship. Because realistically, if the son didn't truly want to come back, he would have run off again at the next possible opportunity. A truly restored relationship needs action on the part of both parties. If one person isn't in it for the long haul, then the relationship will undoubtedly fall apart in the long run. Just as the son's relationship with his father has been restored, we too can know the joy and blessing of walking with God. In God, we find a father who sent his son to take the humiliation that we deserved. Why? So that we, like the prodigal, might be met with grace, mercy, joy, and celebration, because God's heart is full of compassion for his children. And as we come close, we not only find ourselves forgiven in Christ, we find ourselves adopted into his sonship and truly part of his family. That turning back that's not like those airport scenes, but is a daily recognizing of our ways that we have turned away and fallen short. Today we can know the abundant blessing and value of a life spent in right relationship with God, which exceeds the expectations or benefits of a life built on those things that the world teaches us are of value. And just as a son, we find the hope that we have in God is the only true hope, because it is a hope that lasts for all eternity, rather than a hope that is built on temporal things that will one day fade away. In telling the story of the lost son, Jesus was responding to the religious leaders' complaints about his association with tax collectors and the other sinners who they deemed as unworthy of their attention. Here, Jesus is illustrating that God is compassionate and inclusive of all, regardless of their status, regardless of their past misdemeanors, and regardless of how badly they've turned their backs on him. God's grace and his restoration know no bounds. But the challenge isn't just for us as individuals and how we relate to God. It also applies to us as a community of faith. The story challenged the people of the time and us today to consider ways in which we might be gatekeepers of God's grace. Just as the community might have greeted the son with a clay jar, limiting his access to the Father, are there people that we are preventing, consciously or subconsciously, from receiving God's love? If we look out into our communities, we see that there are more people outside of the church than in it on Sunday mornings, many of whom, like the lost son, are seeking to build their lives on the earthly things and are still searching for the meaning that they long for. How can we change? Maybe our patterns of worship, and some of the things that we hold dear, that we might include more people into our community and show them God's grace and love. Because I'm sure many of them might be expecting the greeting, of a smashed jar thrown at their feet. But it's much more akin to the warm, loving welcome of the father's embrace. The parable of is commonly referred to as the story of the lost son or the prodigal son in the singular, but we often forget that the story doesn't end with the younger son's return. Jesus deliberately includes the older brother because he too was lost in his own way. Yes, the younger brother rebelled while the older son remained at home, but his staying wasn't out of faithfulness. He had built himself up to be righteous. Outwardly, it appeared that he was doing the right thing, but inwardly, his actions were motivated by his desire to look like he was doing that and a sense of obligation, rather than doing so out of love for his father and his family. He's done all the right things, working hard with and for his father and fulfilling his duty. He's built up that sense of entitlement, and as his brother returns, he is resentful, angry, and jealous of the way his father has treated his wayward brother. Perhaps for some of us, we can't really relate to the younger brother. We've remained faithful to God since we first came to know him and remained close by his side. But perhaps while we have remained physically close, our hearts have grown cold, resentful or entitled, Jesus is inviting us not only to examine our actions, but the condition of our hearts. The people of Jesus' time were focused on the outward. They obediently kept the Mosaic laws as signs of their faith in God and his choosing of them. They were set apart to be a holy people. Yet many of the religious leaders were more concerned about their external appearances than what was on their hearts. Many of the stories of Jesus' ministry gave an obvious challenge to the assumption that their outward behaviour was what mattered most to God. But here the challenge is much more subtle. The inclusion of the older brother shows us that God doesn't just look upon our actions, he looks right into our hearts. The brother felt his hard work and his obedience to his father earned blessing and celebration. And yes, while those characteristics are to be commended, if our motivation is to earn God's goodness, then we fall short in our expectations of God and in his expectations of us. In seeking to earn God's goodness and his father's goodness, the brother misses out on all that the father has to offer him. He misses out on simply enjoying the presence of his dad, and he becomes resentful of his toils. For us today, good works remain important, but our motivation should never be to earn God's grace or favour. Both brothers learned that God's love and his goodness goes far beyond our expectations. When we speak and sing of God's goodness for us, it isn't a case of running to catch it or running to overcome hurdles to earn it. In his goodness, God runs after us, chasing us like the hounds of heaven, eager for each of us to experience his grace and mercy, not because of anything we have done or anything that we will ever do, but because of what Jesus has already done. As a result, our good works should flow out of us as a response to the grace and mercy that God has already extended, guiding us to welcome others into this family. Are there ways that we are serving begrudgingly, doing things because we've always done them rather than remembering who we're doing them for? And are there ways that we might seek to serve others? Have we thought that we're suddenly collecting brownie badges and points to earn our way to heaven? This week and in all the days to come, may we seek to serve as a token of our thanks for God's goodness to us, grateful for his faithfulness and trusting in his salvation that goes beyond what we could ever earn for ourselves. Earlier, we sang the chorus, "We can always run to Jesus." And while that is true, we must always remember that we can only run to Jesus because he first came to us. And on the days when we can't run, when we're tired from the race, overwhelmed by the external pressures, or when our earthly bodies just aren't up for running anymore, we can trust in the Father, who throws off his sandals and his pride in his relentless pursuit of each of us. The prodigal son shows us that no matter how far we run, God's love runs further. He takes our shame, restores our dignity, and invites us into a relationship that is not half-hearted, but fully renewed. I may never have been much of a runner, and I suspect that I never will be. But this parable reminds me and us today of the only run that matters, the run of the Father who approaches us with his arms opened wide. May that be the run that each of us focuses on today and always. Amen. We're now going to join together.